BOO Portland.
Good morning, and thanks for listening to KBOO Community Radio. I'm Sarika Mehta, and today I'm chatting with author Jean Kwok, who joins us by phone from the East Coast. Jean Kwok is the acclaimed author of the novel Girl in Translation, which was published back in 2010. Her latest novel, Mambo in Chinatown, follows the story of a Chinese-American woman named Charlie Wong, who lives a double life in taking care of her family in New York's Chinatown, while also training as an aspiring ballroom dancer. Jean Kwok tends to share some similarities with her characters, having immigrated to the United States as a child, surviving a difficult childhood while learning a new language in New York. She currently lives in the Netherlands. Her book Mambo in Chinatown comes out tomorrow, and today is the first day of her tour. Jean Kwok, welcome back to KBOO.
I'm so glad to be here.
So, speaking of some of the similarities with your characters, I recently learned that in between your bachelor's and master's education, you were in fact a ballroom dancer. And this is also evidenced by a YouTube video that has served as a promotional piece for your book. Tell us about your experiences with dancing.
Well, you know, the funny thing is that dancing was really not a part of my life for most of it, because I was a really poor child, and we lived in this run-down, you know, unheated apartment in the slums of Brooklyn after we moved from Hong Kong. And, you know, my family worked in a garment factory, so there was no money or time for any kind of extracurricular activities. And I used to envy my friends who would come and talk about their ballet lessons and have those beautiful dresses and flit around the room so beautifully, but that was just not something I could be a part of. Then I grew up, and because I had a certain ability in school, I started to do better, and I eventually went to Harvard. And it was when I was at Harvard that I realized, okay, I'm never going to have to go back to the factory. I can actually do what I want to do, which was to become a writer. And before that time, I had always been fixated on having a financially stable career, because I worked at the factory as well, at the sweatshop in Chinatown. And I, you know, my ambition in life was to not grow old and die working in that factory.
Right. And I think this is the experience of most immigrant families, that having a stable career, something, a dependable paycheck is, well, a very big part of the list of priorities.
Exactly. And so so I had been fixated on that. And so when I made the decision to become a writer, you know, my employment possibilities changed. And at the same time, of course, also because I was in college, I had the opportunity and the access to dance lessons and to all kinds of other things I had not done before. So it was then that I also learned I loved to dance. And at the beginning, I was pretty bad, because a person who is untrained is bad. You know, you're just bad because you don't know how to control your body. You don't know, you know, a lot of basic things that other people who have had some training do know. But I loved it, and so I kept on with it. And after I graduated, I needed a day job. You know, I was looking for a job to support myself so that I could be a writer at night. And I wanted a job that wouldn't consume me. You know, I didn't want a big career, because I'm a pretty compulsive person, and I was afraid that, well, if I start a real career, I'm going to wind up doing that, and I will never write any books. So I was looking in the paper, and I saw this ad that said, "Wanted, professional ballroom dancer will train." And
wow.
It had been put there by Fred Astaire Studios, and I applied for the job. So I was terrified, and I was still like, I had my little Harvard degree, but I had not learned a lot of things. I had not learned how to dress, for example. So I went to this interview in, I had one pair of black pumps. that my friends had given me when I was 16. And I had worn them so much that the paint had peeled off, and instead of being black, they were gray in patches. So I got a black permanent marker, and I colored in my pumps so that they were black from a distance if you didn't look very carefully and if you had bad eyesight. And then I had this huge sack of a red dress that I think somebody had given me. And my hair, my hair was a disaster because I don't remember what I had done to it, but it was like sticking out all over my head. It was really short in that time. It was sticking out everywhere. So I grabbed this long red scarf, which did not match the red of the dress, and but it was the only one I had. And I like wrapped it around my head like this enormous turban, you know? And so I go to the interview, and they were like, huh? But somehow they liked me, and they said to me, well, you can come back for the audition as long as you take that thing off your head. So I took the scarf off the head, and I came back, and I did the audition, and then I passed the audition, and I was allowed to stay for a three-week training course, and actually wasn't really a training course. It was more like a disappearing course, because they taught us how to dance. But every day, people would disappear. You know, part of the group would just never come again, and you never saw anybody being spoken to. They just wouldn't show up the next day. So I, people kept disappearing and disappearing until one day I was the only one left, and I thought, oh, my God, I'm going to disappear too. But actually, I had the job, and that was the beginning of my real dance training.
That is pretty incredible to begin this kind of a training so late in your life, and then to be, I mean, just to become professional at it. Oftentimes people begin some kind of an activity like this so early, you know, from childhood, and if they're lucky, they can become professionals. This brings up a number of issues. I see now the similarities between your experiences and the protagonist, Charlie Wong, in the story, including the red scarf and the black pumps.
That's right.
And the reaction of the interviewers. And I think, you know, in nowadays, there is something to be said about, you know, we try to not judge people by the way they dress and this, that, and the other. We try to look at their character. But I'm also trying to put on the hat of reality where these are dancers in New York.
Right.
There's going to be some element of judgment. Regardless, you know, this is the interesting thing is that this is a world of ballroom dancing, which traditionally is housed in a very upper class world. And the character, Charlie Wong, comes from definitely working class Chinatown, working in her father's noodle shop. These are two very, very distinct worlds she's navigating throughout the story. I was wondering if you could comment on navigating that dyad, that these very opposing forces in her life at a young age.
Yeah, well, it was, you know, that was very much what I wanted to talk about in this book, you know, and it's what I had gone through as well, because I have a real working class background, and I was able to leave that life, but actually so many family and friends did not. You know, I know so many people who are still working day and night just simply to survive. And I wanted to write this book about a girl with a working class background. I think that we go through our lives and we interact with so many people whom we never really see. And I mean people like the girl behind the takeout counter, you know, the person who's cleaning the floor in your building, the taxi driver. So many people that are just invisible to us. And, you know, those people have dreams and hopes and aspirations and, you know, histories and loves. And I wanted to write about somebody from that world and, you know, and what happened to them and how their life developed. So, and of course, indeed, when you come from working class Chinatown, and you become a dancer, you are in, especially a ballroom dancer, you are in two very different worlds that conflict with each other in many ways. And I like that. I thought that it would be interesting for my reader to both see what inner Chinatown is like, which because I think it's still actually quite a closed world, and what the professional ballroom world is like, and how, you know, like my character Charlie, she struggles with duty to her father and duty to her sister, because she also loves them so much and they love her as well, and she's changing because she starts to find her own talents in the dance studio. But as she changes, the people she loves the most say, "What's happened to you? You're not the person I thought you were." And that's a large part of what I wanted to write about in this book.
That is actually a good segue to my next question. This transition she's experiencing, which isn't—it's not a bad thing. I mean, you know, again, we are judging people based on how they dress and this, that, and the other, her haircut and everything. But really, it came. To me, it was more that she was having confidence in herself for the first time. And I think she was feeling very guilty about how that was making her change with regards to her family, but at the same time being successful in this newfound talent that she never knew she had, that nobody knew. And it spoke a lot to the experiences of people like us in these circumstances. Do you have any more comments about that?
Oh, yeah, I think you're very right. I mean, it is... of course, you know, being attractive, people always think, yes, do you have the right body? Do you have the right clothing? Do you have the right makeup on? But something I really learned from my time in the professional dance world is that beauty really comes from within. And, you know, if you see a dancer when they're off on their breaks and they're just kind of hanging out, they just look like one of us, you know. They're just sitting around munching a bag of potato chips. But when you see them get on the floor and they pull themselves together, they completely transform. And someone who's actually quite plain becomes very charismatic and beautiful. And like you said, that's more a function of confidence and believing in who you really are than any kind of physical or superficial characteristic.
Another question I had related to the world of ballroom dancing, from your own experiences, it's probably not common to see a Chinese-American woman from Chinatown enroll in the world of ballroom dancing. Can you speak a little bit, or I guess, how would you characterize, say, the demographics of ballroom dancing? Did you ever feel like the odd person out?
Well, you know, the funny thing is that actually, although, I mean, there are more and more Asians doing ballroom now, but when I was doing it, there weren't that many indeed. But the funny thing was that I worked for Fred Astaire Studio in New York, and they were one of the best studios in the country, and they imported, and I think they still do, I think a lot of studios do this, they imported the best dancers they could find from all over the world, regardless of race, religion, or anything. It really just had to do with your dance talent. So even though, you know, ballroom, especially private ballroom lessons, are very expensive, and it is a certain type of person who can afford to take them, in general, although obviously you have, you know, less expensive lessons as well. The studio itself was extremely international when I was there, and, you know, everyone was kind of struggling with an accent and trying to learn how to figure out how to navigate this strange American world. And, you know, you have Russians, you have Filipinos, you have all different kinds of cultures and ethnicities all together in one area, which is partly why it's such an interesting world.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to KBOO Community Radio. I'm Sari Gametta, and I'm chatting with Jean Kwok by phone. She's the author of two novels. The latest is called Mambo in Chinatown. We've been talking about Jean Kwok's own experiences in the professional ballroom dancing world and how this inspired the book Mambo in Chinatown. So again, another piece of the puzzle in the story of Charlie Wong and her experiences in ballroom dancing, one of the heartbreaking aspects of the story is that she's keeping this from her family, well, from her father primarily, out of fear of his reaction, being kind of a more traditional and conservative fellow. Even things that got lost in translation, like when he does come to learn about her lessons and her training, she says that she is a dancer, and he comes to understand that as a dancing girl, like in a bar, instead of a something closer to what her mother did as a ballerina. Can you talk about this experience a little bit?
Yes, I think that that's a conflict that many people experience, especially second generation immigrants, where the first generation, the parents, have transplanted themselves to a new culture, and in their eyes, they are already being as flexible as they could possibly be. They have already bent as much as they could. But yet, for the younger generation that's growing up, you know, it's far from enough, because, you know, you see your friends, and their parents give them so much more freedom, and they have such different expectations than your parents might. And that's something that Charlie really encounters with her father. But something that I wanted to come across in the book was both sides of the story. There's not that her father is bad or evil in any way. He's a wonderful, kind, loving man who's absolutely doing the best he can for his two daughters, but he just doesn't really know how, and he doesn't want to do it wrong. So then he sticks to what he knows, which means that when Lisa, Charlie's younger sister, gets sick, the father insists on treating her only with Eastern medicine and not with Western. And that's something that, you know, I encountered also in my own family. When my father became ill, my family only wanted to treat him with Eastern medicine. And then Charlie has that frustration of, well, I'd like to get her an MRI. You know, I'd like to get her diagnosed. But they are not insured, and her father is against it. And Charlie has to come up with the money somehow to get Lisa treated. And so that kind of brings the whole conflict with the father to a head.
Exactly. That was another storyline that I really loved, was the balance of Eastern and Western medicine, losing a patient to the healthcare system and trusting only what you know, which is completely understandable. And do you feel that this speaks to the same reason why many minority communities just don't trust mainstream medicine, and they won't invest even any trust in it?
That's right. You know, I had a couple of doctors read the book, because I just wanted advice on certain medical aspects. And the feedback was really amazing, because they said, you know, I recognize this. Someone I knew who worked in an area close to Chinatown said, you know, it's you have patients who literally die because they have symptoms that they are not willing to tell you about or to share with you because they feel that they cannot report it for some reason. And then you could have helped them, you could have saved them, but yet because of that reticence, that silence in the end hurts them tremendously.
Exactly. And speaking of the younger sister in the story, Lisa, her plot line, I can't give away the ending of the story, but she is also in some fashion leading a double life. It is very obvious to the family that she is suffering some mysterious illness, and figuring out what it is and the root of it is, you know, a large part of the story. What was the greater story you wanted to tell through her plot line?
I think indeed what you just said about living a double life, how, you know, inside a family there is so much love, but so many other emotions as well that can interfere with it. And then every family I know has secrets, you know, and it's people feel that they are not able to share those secrets, and maybe rightly so. Maybe, you know, those are things that would be very difficult to share. But then you wind up living in, you know, Charlie, since her father's a widower, their mother passed away years ago, Charlie, the father, and the sister live in this tiny little Chinatown apartment. And yet, they're all living in a different world, you know. They all have their own secrets. And Lisa, of course, was the bright one in the family, so she has to apply to take a test for one of the New York's elite schools, and then she has to go up against kids who are much better prepared than she is. And, you know, she has her own struggles and, you know, her own world that she's living in. And then Charlie, of course, has gone into the dance world, which her father knows nothing about, and that she's afraid to tell him. And, you know, her father is just in the Chinatown world, working as hard as he can, desperately to take care of his two girls. And, you know, you have all of that happening in one tiny little apartment.
Right. Everyone in the family is just really going above and beyond to make things barely work. You know, it's difficult. And speaking of which, I noticed in both of the novels, in the previous one, your first novel, Girl in Translation, and again in this novel, Mambo in Chinatown, both protagonists are coping with managing families in single-parent households with the reliance, with the help of older siblings who are considered, you know, wiser and having guidance and the obligations that come with this dynamic. Was this a coincidence, or is there something else behind the motivation of this storyline?
I think, you know, when you write, it's a large part of what you do is unconscious. So, you know, I write books that mean something to me. I write books that I care about deeply, and that, you know, I write about characters that I really love. And so I don't know why this was the story I needed to tell, but it was. And I think part of it, of course, has to do with my own immigrant experience, where I moved here with my older brothers and my parents. And I had a mom, a mother, and a father, but my father was sick for much of the time. So my mother really had the burden of being a single parent. And I remember, you know, watching her sitting behind next to the oven in our apartment, because our apartment didn't have any central heating. And it's in New York City, which gets incredibly cold in the winter. So we would turn on the oven and open the door, and just, you know, that would be the
in order to heat the apartment.
Yeah, and it didn't heat the apartment, believe me. It just heated like a foot around the oven, but it was something. It was a lot better than nothing. And because we worked at the factory, we our work was never done. You know, we never could get enough of it done on time. So my mother would bring home every night these huge sacks of clothing. And because you need manual dexterity to do factory work, the apartment was much too cold. I mean, we had to wear gloves and our coats in most of the apartment. So because of that, in order to do anything where you could had to take off your gloves, she would sit by the oven. And I remember her just nodding off night after night because she was so tired, and yet she couldn't go to bed because the work wasn't finished. And, you know, that that memory is just something that stays with me. And, you know, my father did his best to help, but because he wasn't doing that well health-wise, the burden really fell on her. And then, of course, I also had my older brothers who tried to help as much as they could. So I guess that is the kind of family structure that was imprinted on me when I wrote both of these books.
I wanted to take a little bit of time to chat about something completely different. You had recently written a piece for Time magazine commenting about New York schools doing away with a single test application in an effort to be more inclusive of other demographics. And before we get into your commentary, can you first explain the system as it stands?
The system in New York City is that there are some specialized elite schools at the high school level, junior high school and high school level. And there are many different schools with different admission systems, but the most famous schools in New York and the most competitive ones have a single test system. That means that you take one test, and, you know, if you score above a certain amount, you're in, and if you don't score that amount, you are out. And in recent years, there has been a lot of controversy about this because the tests are not letting in enough African-American and Latino students. That's one problem. And the other problem is that as those schools become ever more popular, affluent parents send their kids to test prep programs. You know, there's a whole market that sprung up around those tests. And the fear is that the tests are unfair because, you know, some kids are getting prepped for them while disadvantaged kids are not able to be prepared.
Right. And then your commentary spoke more about, you know, while we look at an inclusive applicant, still many students don't have opportunities for other, you know, what is it called, extracurricular activities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but they are proposing a change in the legislature from that test, from changing it from a single test system to one that's more like would include, you know, interviews or possibly extracurriculars or attendance. But they're not sure yet. The law is very undefined. Or, you know, teacher recommendations. And, you know, what I wrote in my essay is that I believe that those changes are so well-intentioned, and I completely support the intention behind them, which is to, you know, let in the students that need to be let in. But I am afraid that doing that is not the way to fix the problem. I'm not saying that the one test system should remain unchanged, but I am saying that for a poor child, which I was, you know, without any kind of support, if you add on things they have to do, like an interview or mm-hmm. have to have extracurricular activities, you are making it very, very hard for certain families. I mean, families that are working day and night to survive, right. they can barely take a day off to take the child to the test. You know, the child has to be prepared for an interview on top of it, for example, you know, or if you take teacher recommendations. I mean, of course, there are wonderful, wonderful teachers, but there are also teachers that are not as wonderful who may well dislike a child because of its skin color. Mm-hmm. And maybe the child has a difficult home life and acts up in class, so you can understand why the teacher dislikes the child, but they are not 100% foolproof. That's what I'm saying.
Right.
So my point in the essay was just to think more carefully before we make something like this into law, because I know that for a disadvantaged child, those hurdles are enormous. And the fact is, an affluent parent that can game the system in terms of a test can game the system in terms of interviews and extracurriculars and everything else. You know, they're going to be in a better position to prepare their children no matter what you do. And I'm just afraid that a change like this will exclude more than it includes the kids we're trying to reach.
That is a very good point with bringing up a student's access to resources and how this may or may not help the system. So thank you for bringing that up. We have to wrap up. We're just running out of time. But before we do, I was wondering, what is next on the horizon for you? I know your tour just started today, and that's sort of a loaded question. but are you working on anything else, or what's next for you?
Well, you know, first of all, of course, I have to get through this two-week tour. So I'm going all through the U.S., and if any listeners would like to meet me at any of my events, I would love to say hi to you. My my events are all up on my website, which is at jeanquok.com. But for me, writing-wise, the next thing I'm working on is a book about a young woman who moves from the U.S. to Amsterdam.
Great. Well, Jean Kwok, thank you so much for joining me here on KBOO Community Radio. I wish you the best of luck on the tour and your future endeavors. Thank you.
Well, thank you, because I love KBOO and I love being interviewed by you. So thank you so much as well. Have a great day now.
You too. That was Jean Kwok, author of Mambo in Chinatown, which comes out tomorrow. You can learn more about her fascinating life at her website, jeanquok.com. That's K-W-O-K. I'm Sarika Mehta, and thanks for listening to KBOO Community Radio.
Go ahead. And now, the KBOO News at Noon for Monday, June 23rd. As the violence in Iraq intensifies, Secretary of State John Kerry is in the country to meet with Prime Minister Nuri Maliki and top Sunni and Kurdish leaders. The Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, known as ISIS, captured more territory, including a key Syrian border crossing, over the weekend. ISIS is determined to create an Islamic State in Iraq and in Syria based on a political interpretation of Islam. At least 71 prisoners and 5 police officers were killed Monday outside of Baghdad when militants attacked an Iraqi police convoy transferring inmates from one prison to another. Iraq's military is accusing ISIS of carrying out massacres. Prime Minister Maliki's Shiite-dominated government is under pressure to be more inclusive of Sunnis. Thousands of volunteers and recruits marched in the capital and other Shiite-dominated cities over the weekend in a show of force intended to boost morale, but made Sunnis and other minority groups even more nervous. Syria has shipped out the last of its known stocks of chemical weapons for destruction overseas, according to the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. The organization also made clear that they could not say categorically that Syria no longer possessed any chemical weapons. 4 months will be required to complete the destruction of Syria's toxic arsenal, which included mustard gas, precursor chemicals for sarin gas, and other nerve agents. Destruction of some Syrian chemical agents has started in Finland. In a split decision today, the Supreme Court upheld most of the Obama administration's environmental rules designed to limit greenhouse gases from power plants. In a 7-2 vote, the justices agreed the Environmental Protection Agency could force major polluters to use new and better technology to limit their emissions of carbon dioxide. However, in a separate 5-4 vote, the court struck down an EPA regulation that could have extended the required greenhouse gas permits to millions of other facilities. EPA officials did welcome the ruling. The Portland Bureau of Transportation has decided to relocate Tuesday's town hall on the proposed transportation fee to the Oregon Convention Center. The event is free and open to the public and is intended to focus on how the transportation fee would work for businesses, nonprofits, and other non-residential land uses. A transportation user fee